Namaste, greetings. Welcome to Indigenous Insights. I'm your host, Gladys Rowe, and I'm so grateful you are here. Each episode, I sit in conversation with Indigenous evaluation practitioners, leaders, researchers, and scholars who are working in, thinking about, and supporting Indigenous evaluation to share the learning they've experienced along the way. My hope is that these episodes allow you to reflect on how to design, implement, learn from, and support evaluation by, with, and for Indigenous families, communities, organizations, and nations. Join me and my guests as we open up our evaluation bundles to share what we've gathered in our journeys and bring them together into this space. I hope in these stories you will come to understand how we can collectively contribute to decolonial futures and strengthen Indigenous resurgence. Okay, super excited. I'm here today with Sam Bird, who is a citizen of Peguis First Nation, currently residing in Thunder Bay, Ontario. She's a program partner at the MasterCard Foundation Canada Programs with a focus on youth engagement. She's passionate about creating system change for Indigenous young people. Outside of work, she loves to enjoy all that Northwestern Ontario has to offer when it comes to hiking, canoeing, and skiing. Sam is also an emerging writer, with work included in the newly released Carving Space, the Indigenous Voices Awards anthology. Sam is the host of Young People Know, a five-part podcast series featuring the voices and experiences of young Indigenous leaders. The podcast explores the principles of effective, meaningful, and genuine youth engagement. In conversation with Indigenous young people from across Canada, the series shares the challenges, benefits, and opportunities they face in serving on advisory councils while working to create transformative change that embeds Indigenous values, priorities, and protocols into the organizations and systems that affect their lives. Welcome, Sam. I'm so glad to share this space with you today.
Thank you for having me, Gladys. It's fun to get to be here.
Yeah, awesome. Before we jump into our conversation, I'm wondering if there's any other way that you'd like to introduce yourself into the space before we get started.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just thinking about it earlier and thinking, okay, I should add like fun or interesting things about myself. But then I realized in my bio, all my outside of stuff work is listed too. But I guess I will say, like, I'll just introduce myself in Anishinaabemowin. And Samantha Nadishnikas, Animki Wikwadon Natonchi. My name is Samantha and I live in Thunder Bay. My family on my dad's side is mixed Cree and Soto from Peguis First Nation. And on my mom's side, we're of like German speaking Swiss descent, strong like Mennonite roots on my mom's side from Southern Ontario. And yeah, I'm really excited to be here with you today.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. So in the introduction, I shared a little bit about the titles that you have and some roles that you have, but if you could share with me and the listeners, maybe a little bit more about the work that you're doing right now.
Yeah. So as you mentioned in my introduction, I'm a program partner at the MasterCard Foundation with a focus on youth engagement. So young people are important to all that I do because it's right in my job description. And yeah, I think maybe for those who are unfamiliar with the MasterCard Foundation, I could maybe explain just a little bit what that means and how that shows up in my work. So the MasterCard Foundation is independent of MasterCard, the corporate company. It's a Canadian foundation based in Toronto. And in Canada, our work exists under the program of ELEV, that's E-L-E-V. And our work in Canada is focused on creating systems change for Indigenous young people on their pathways, both through post-secondary education and also into meaningful livelihoods. And so my role as a youth engagement program partner is to help our team and to help our partners really strategize and think through how are young people not just beneficiaries of our work, but how are they partners and how are they involved in the ongoing design and delivery of our programs?
Wonderful. Yeah. So the priority and interest for working with Indigenous youth, like you said, is baked right into the title of the work that you do at MasterCard Foundation. But I'm wondering if the interest of working with Indigenous youth and the priorities came even before the role that you hold. And where did this priority of working with Indigenous youth come from for you?
That's a really good question. Like, where did my interest in working with Indigenous young people emerge from? Because it has been a part of my life and my focus even before working at the foundation, previously working in schools and in libraries. And I guess because I'm still an Indigenous young person myself, I'm only 29, you know, and so I feel like it just makes sense to focus on Indigenous young people because, you know, if they benefit, I benefit. And I think, yeah, I really want to see our people do well and have every possible opportunity. And so I think the motivation I have in it is so like intrinsic. It's who I am myself. And I think in general, like colonialism has been sown into this territory and into our communities so deeply. And so there's still so much work that's needed to like unsew it and to take it out and to live lives that are full of opportunity.
Yeah, beautiful. And of course you're interested in it because you're also a young person.
Yeah.
For me, engaging young people in work that directly impacts them makes a lot of sense. And it pushes back against so much of how colonial systems, Eurocentric systems operate in terms of like saying, we're the experts and we're going to make decisions and we know what's right for you. And so that it just makes sense, you know, having Indigenous young people ensuring that they have a say in everything that impacts them. And so when you think about why the podcast was important for you to start, like in sharing this priority of youth voice leading the way, what drew you to hosting this podcast?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, a few different things. So I think, first of all, like we're asking all of our partners to have youth involved in the ongoing design and delivery of their programs. And so I feel very conscious of the fact, like if we're funding initiatives where institutions and organizations then are going to be attempting to, at least in an ideal world, they're all attempting to at least do this work of youth engagement. What if they go out there and they do it really poorly? And what if they cause a lot of harm? Like that's worst case scenario, I guess, in the ways that they do it. I feel like indirectly responsible, like we've partnered and dispersed to people and then they're out there potentially doing a subpar job at it. This is just, I'm not saying any of our partners do this, but that's just where my thinking goes. Like, what if that happens? Like, how can we account for it? And so I think that was part of it. Like, how can I create a resource for them so that they can do it in a more informed way? Because we have partners kind of all across a whole spectrum of involvement when it comes to youth engagement. And so I think that was part of it. If we're getting behind certain initiatives, I want to be able to do my part in helping them do it in the best possible way. That was part of it. I feel like there's nothing new under the sun. And I feel like I've seen sometimes like youth engagement or like gatherings have like the same sort of issues sometimes, or things that I'm like, oh, like, don't we know already that this isn't the way to do it? Or like, this could have been avoided, or just like certain things could have been problem solved before. And so I was thinking like, wouldn't it be great if there was a resource for people to hear directly from Indigenous young people about their experiences so they can have maybe just a very baseline understanding that they can get before going out and engaging young people? And I think also like the idea of having like a reusable resource, like when you gather a youth group or focus group to talk about an initiative, it can kind of just be for that moment in time that you're hearing those voices and perspectives. But something like a podcast can be a resource that is accessed by anyone with connection to the internet and they can benefit from the collection of that, interviewed each of those young people one time at one point, but then many people could benefit from the learnings gleaned from it.
Mm-hmm.
And also I think the alternative would have been to like write a paper on like wise practices and youth engagement. And I like writing, but I didn't want to write a paper. I feel like, oh, I want to create something a bit more interactive. So that was part of my motivation too.
Awesome. So before we hit record, you told me that this was an 18-month long process for you. And so now that you're at the end of this, are you still excited that you did this rather than writing a paper?
I feel like I learned so much about myself in the past 18 months. With this, yeah, I think maybe part of why I didn't want to write a paper is because I I was scared about, what about the moments where I'm just staring at a blank page, feeling a bit paralyzed in what to write? But you know, that happened in writing the narrative for this podcast anyways. So I didn't get to avoid that sort of pain anyways.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I think I am glad to have done a podcast, because even though it took so much longer than anyone originally anticipated, yeah, I'm glad it's finally out there. And yeah, I'm really glad.
And the episodes are amazing. So I really, really love the strategy that you took in terms of the topics that you covered in the podcast. And we're going to jump into that right away, because if the listeners, after they listen to this episode and all of the sharing that you do about young people know, I know they're going to go on and listen to these episodes, because this podcast is focused on Indigenous evaluation. But we talk about granting, we talk about funders, we talk about the way that things need to be different in order for Indigenous evaluation to be set up and done in a really good way that's rooted in practices that are true to our communities, our ways of knowing, being, and doing. And part of that is making sure that there's space to be guided by and listen to the voices of those who are impacted. And young people, there's so much programming out there and funding out there for programming for young people, and it needs to actually be evaluated by the young people themselves. And so I'm excited to talk about the content of the episodes with you, and wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the episodes and kind of the overarching themes. And then I have a ton of other questions after that.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. It's interesting even to reflect on like the long process. And part of the initial process was determining those themes. Like me and my co-producer, Joanne Fishburne from Indigenous 150 Plus, we spent a lot of time sort of brainstorming and then articulating what we wanted the 5 thematic episodes to look like, even before we really got into the interviews. And that kind of went against every natural instinct that I have, where some people are really methodical and are like, ready, aim, fire. Oh, and I'm just like, fire, like, just let's just jump into it. But looking back, I'm so glad that she led me in that way, because it might have been a lot more chaotic if not. Okay, so episode 1 is called This Stems Back to Being Named After My Great Grandmother. And it's a focus on identity and community building a little bit, but a lot on how Indigenous identity is pretty varied and complex. And really, what I was thinking about in this episode is professionals who may be Indigenous, may not be Indigenous, working for institutions, working for schools, working for nonprofits. What might they need to be mindful of when it comes to Indigenous identity? And that's sort of like my target audience in all of this. As we go through this, if some people are listening to this thinking, well, as an Indigenous person, you wouldn't even have to mention this. Like, I know, like, like, this is meant for like people who might not be Indigenous, or they are Indigenous, but really like they're a professional looking to engage young people. And so that's why maybe sometimes the advice might seem to other people like quite rudimentary. It's a bit intentional. So yeah, so episode 1 is identity, and episode 2 is called I Love That You Think We Deserve Suits. It's youth engagement and participation. So that episode looks at, like, practically when you're in the room with a dozen Indigenous young people, how do you work and act and behave in a way that will elicit fulsome participation? Sometimes Indigenous youth might not be that talkative, and what do you do in those situations to make people feel safe? And sometimes Indigenous youth are like yelling at you for being a dink. And what do you need to know about those situations? And so, yeah, that episode title 2, I Love That You Think We Deserve Suits, that comes from Darian from White Sand First Nation. That's a direct quote from his interview in that. And then I should also say in episode 1, This Stems Back to Being Named After My Great-Grandmother is a quote from Christine Tutu, who is one of the Inuit young people that I interviewed. So episode 3 is Let's Chat About Good Policy That Works for People, Youth Engagement and Policy Change. And again, that's a quote from Darian. We really benefited a lot from that interview, got a lot of mileage out of it. And so that one, there's kind of like 2 focuses. It's all about like youth-led policy change. And The first half sort of looks at like policy changes or structural changes that young people have made or aspire to make internal to their youth advisory or student union or board. And then the second part looks at then externally to that group, where have Indigenous young people led change outside of their institution that then has impacted Indigenous young people more widely, or even Canadians more widely. Yeah, so that's what episode 3 is about. It's probably one of my favorite episodes. And then the fourth episode looks at, I think this is Darian again. If Darian ever listens to this interview, like, thank you, Darian. We should double your honorarium for this. Episode 4 is called, How Does This Support the Bus Ride Home? It's another quote from Darian, youth engagement and compensation. And so this episode looks at like being paid, basically, but then it's about a lot more than that. It's about like young people maybe feeling like they don't deserve compensation, young people being compensated less than they deserve, talking about it with whoever is engaging you, compensation that goes beyond monetary compensation. So looking at reciprocity in a bigger way. So that's what episode 4 is about. And episode 5 is a special focus on leadership development. It's called, We Can't Just Hope That the Right Leaders Come Along, Youth Engagement and Leadership Development. And this episode's a little bit different because all the other ones I'm sort of including clips from interviews from like 3 to 5 different interviews, or sometimes more actually. Whereas episode 5 is like a special focused highlight on the life and leadership of Jocelyn Formsma. Jocelyn Formsma is the CEO of the National Association of Friendship Centers. And in that episode, we look at all of the ways she got involved with youth engagement throughout her 20s, I think a bit in her teen years as well. And then like all of the things she learned in those spaces and how it led to her eventually going to university, going to law school, becoming a lawyer, becoming the CEO of a national nonprofit. So kind of to look at like, yeah, what is possible in youth engagement spaces and how those spaces are either sort of serve like a dual purpose. Like there's the institution that wants to know how to be effective and relevant in their initiatives. And then there's also an opportunity for that young person to grow as a leader and to receive like practical skills and development. So,
I love the titles of the episodes, first of all. Props to Darian, who contributed to most of that. Awesome hooks there. The episode on compensation is standing out to me because I listened to that one last, and thinking about like there was a conversation or there were clips in there that, well, first of all, there's Indigenous youth sitting in the room potentially with like CEOs and all of these other people who are getting paid like $1,000 a day to be there, and they're getting paid like maybe $80 a day to be there. Like, what stark inequality and disvaluing of the knowledge that the youth bring into that space. And thinking about flying youth into cities from other areas and having to leave their families behind, and like, what are the costs of that in order to ensure participation? I'm wondering if there was any, or since the recording and producing of the episodes, like, do you have any examples of promising practices or shining lights? And you might not, and so I might be setting myself up for a failure of a question here, but like people who are trying to do compensation differently and are thinking about some of the things that came up in that episode, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that.
I think in terms of thinking about compensation differently, the parts of that episode where I talked with Riley Yesno about compensation were really interesting. She was sort of talking about some things that maybe are a bit different than compensating someone for participation on a youth advisory, because she talked a bit about more like when she's speaking somewhere or hosting a workshop or whatever, like it's a more involved request, how she articulates like how much she should be paid. And so she talked about a couple of things that I thought were really interesting. Like she thought through like the time that she'll not just need to prepare and travel and be there and present, but then also the time that she'll need to recuperate from the event, and kind of factoring that in to like, those are kind of hours out of her life. And so being compensated for that time as well, and being compensated for, yeah, the time that she'll need to sort of like recharge and refill after giving and giving in some of those situations. And then she talked about like calculating it based on like an hourly rate of what the living wage is in her city, and then having that as sort of a baseline. And so I thought that was really interesting and a way to sort of like, I think sometimes like the numbers for honorarium or speaking fees can feel a bit maybe abstract or like out of nowhere, or like, yeah, I have a sense that that's enough, or I have a sense that that's way too much, but not really know why. And so I feel like her thinking through a living wage hourly rate as a baseline, and then thinking through not just the hours needed to present, but the hours needed to prepare, to travel, and then also to recuperate, if it means that she knows that like for 1 to 2 days afterwards, she's not going to have the bandwidth to do other work. So being compensated for that as well. So I thought that was interesting. I think also in that episode, Autumn LaRose Smith from Saskatchewan, she's the Métis Nation Saskatchewan Youth Advisory President, something along those lines. She described the idea of like meeting with her youth council. This was something that they were talking about like aspiring to do. So I don't know like if it happened, but I thought it was a really interesting idea, and having sort of an open dialogue about how much do you think you should be compensated? How much, like, let's have an open discussion about it. And I think that sort of like openness is really interesting. It made me think about like, what would it look like if you're working for a nonprofit with a really limited budget to have a really open conversation? Like, this is our programming budget for the year, and from this budget, you'll be paid. And also any activities that we do will come from this, and things in the community, so that youth could have a really like clear understanding of, yeah, how much money is there actually available? And maybe then they would choose like more or less depending on kind of knowing the overall scope. I personally think it would be really interesting if smaller organizations with really limited resources had really open, transparent discussions with young people about what their overall budget is, how much is set aside for programs, and then from there, how much do they want to have set aside for their honorarium, instead of it just being like this kind of number that comes out of the sky out of nowhere, like we're getting X dollar amount for X activity. Mm-hmm. And because I think you might have situations that, especially for smaller organizations, where youth are like, okay, if that's genuinely like our overall budget, maybe we'll opt for a smaller honorarium so that we can do more in the community. I don't know. But I think having an idea of that would be good, because it could just give those numbers like.
Yeah, I really love that idea of having the ability to view budgets and to see like where honorarium fit in the context of things. And that's really innovative for me in terms of decision-making power and autonomy, and really youth potentially having meaningful contribution to the disbursements and the decisions around funding, right? That's awesome and super exciting. And in that episode too, you mentioned this first example when Riley shared about the self-care funding. Like, that just blew my mind to think about like how to compensate for the emotional labor and then the resulting rebalancing that has to happen in many situations that Indigenous peoples are asked to sit in and to be representative in and advising in, holding that kind of space, and then making sure that you don't burn out afterwards. Like, that was amazing to me. And I did like a little like, what, when I listened to that part of the episode. But those are great, great contributions. From the other episodes, like, are there any other promising practices that stand out to you when you take an eagle eye view of all of the episodes of Young People Know? What else stands out to you as important to share as a promising mm-hmm. practice?
Yeah, I think of Autumn LaRose Smith from Saskatchewan. They shared with me a few different things about their time as the president of the University of Saskatchewan Student Union. And a few different things, like straightforward things that are still like kind of life-changing because no one else is doing it. And so one of the stories she told me about was how the student union never really spoke directly with a faculty union. And so when they had issues with faculty, like when students were bringing forth concerns about how there was like complaints or concerns when it came to faculty, like how courses were being run or issues like that, the student union then had to kind of bring them to administration, who would then talk with faculty, but they didn't really just talk with faculty directly. And so Autumn brought forward this practice where the student union met directly with a faculty union to address those concerns, which I feel like, oh, like this is something they should be doing on university campuses all across the country. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is like a really amazing, like simple innovation. And then Autumn also led a really incredible initiative, getting the administration to agree to a memorandum of understanding with the student union. So like an official contract or like an official understanding between the two when it comes to efforts around anti-racism. And so out of those negotiations, they got the university to commit to having a fund for students to apply, I think essentially for like small grants to lead student-led anti-racism initiatives on campus. And then they also got the faculty to commit, or not the faculty, sorry, the administration to commit to taking anti-racism training. And she sort of talks about how for a while the administration kept saying like, oh yeah, we're going to do it, we're going to do it. But Autumn had to really push for that to actually be included in writing in the MOU. And so I think that's amazing. I think universities committing to do anti-racism training is like the bare minimum, but I think it's such important work. And I was really impressed with Autumn, like hearing that story.
Yeah. And I'm thinking a lot about like the themes that came through in the episodes and what this could mean for doing evaluation differently, like active, meaningful, ongoing engagement that's well supported, that is thinking about things like the MOU that you talked about with the university there and how that came forward as a promising practice. Like, how can evaluation work, research work as well, I mean, they're so interconnected, be explicit about how the project, how the leads want to work with youth, want to work with community, and how can that agreement be something that's co-created so that everyone knows what to expect. Everyone knows what the budget is. Everyone knows where they fit in the work and the way that they can contribute. There's so many massive lessons here that I think are so important in thinking about like evaluation and research, and then therefore like funding and granting and all of the different kind of spiraling implications.
Yeah, one of the things that comes to mind is there were several people that I talked to who spoke to the importance of co-creating the terms of reference with the youth advisory. And so agreeing together on like the scope and responsibilities of people involved. Yeah, actually, it was interesting. One of the young people I talked to spoke about how they like continue to amend their terms of reference to sort of keep each other accountable. And so like finding that when participation drops off from some representatives, that there should actually be something in the terms of reference about how if you miss a certain amount, like you're invited to end your time on the advisory, and other measures they put forward to sort of mitigate maybe favoritism or some nepotism in who gets appointed to an advisory when it's an appointment process. And so I thought that was really interesting, the way they were sort of like, they were self like governing themselves and making their body like more efficient for themselves. But sorry, your question was about like the implications for ongoing like learning and evaluation. I mean, I think that's an example of like they themselves were learning about what worked best for them.
Yeah, totally. And I'm wondering if there's any challenges that were really highlighted in your episodes that might connect to this space of what needs to be done differently? Like, what are the challenges that came forward?
Okay, so your question about what are some of the challenges in the work of youth engagement that sort of emerged over the course of the series. One thing that came up from a couple different people was that, for instance, maybe the president of their youth advisory then had a dual role, both on that advisory, but then on the board or within the greater governance structure of whatever institution that that youth advisory served. However, their role to that larger board or governance mechanism was participatory and non-voting. And I highlight this specifically with Brian Pottle and the National Inuit Youth Council, but it wasn't just him. It was, I'm pretty sure, also with the Métis Nation Alberta, their youth rep. It's a more of a participatory role they then have with the greater Métis Nation Alberta. I'm not meaning to like try to call out ITK or the MNA, but those are just specific examples that are, I think it happens all over the country. And so it just made me think about, okay, if for organizations, I think the challenge is, especially if they really pride themselves in being youth led, to really think about then, how are they actually formalizing their commitment to sharing power with young people? Hmm. Like if they truly want to be led by young people, are they willing to have them have an actual real stake and vote and voice in the greater governance structure? Or does it remain sort of like a group that they can receive insight and feedback from and then kind of do whatever they want with that information? Or are they going to surrender power basically and allow young people to maybe in some cases be the deciding vote or to have a vote that actually needs to be lobbied for and won for certain votes, especially when that greater governing body is like maybe a small amount of people voting on issues. I think that would be a real game changer in some cases. I think it's a way for organizations then to really hold themselves accountable to young people, that it's not just a body that they can consult, but it's one that they must always consider in their decision making. In some of the episodes, we get into like, what are the implications of that? And why is that not just an easy thing to do? But yeah, get into that more in some of the episodes. I think another challenge that came up, and we didn't really kind of get into this too much, but I'm reminded of in one of the interviews, again, Darian is one of the most, there was like almost like 10 interviewees, but his was very memorable in many ways. Like he was giving the example of like, if someone wants to meet them for 7 a.m. breakfast, he's like, I'm going to double my rates because, you know, I know you're not going to like listen to my advice anyways. Like you should be buying me dinner, not making me get up extra early for your dumb strategy plan. Like something along those lines.
Yeah.
And just reflecting on it now, it makes me think about how young people know when you're bullshitting them. Like young people know when you're not actually going to take into account the input that they're giving you. And so, yeah, I think you have to genuinely be willing to like be informed and moved by their advice and insight. Another challenge that I think about that came up, I think maybe something I don't explore too much in it is like, why is youth engagement important? Sort of the assumption throughout the series is like, I'm assuming you already know that it's important and we're talking about like how to do it. And I think through a lot of the stories, we demonstrate why it's important and why it can be so effective. And I'm just reminded of the last episode in the interview with Jocelyn. She talks about how, like, if an organization actually cares about doing youth engagement, they'll do it, you know, like they'll make it happen. And it does take leadership that's committed to it. But I think a lot of the reasons people give for like why progress isn't being made or why progress is slow is like a lot of nonsense. You know, like if an institution really cares about doing something, like they'll make it happen. I just thought that was interesting that like ultimately like leadership needs to be committed to it, because so many of our institutions in this country are like filled with bureaucracy and like a lot of nonsense. So it does take someone committed to it.
Yeah. You pointed to one of the questions that I had coming into this is like, why is it important that we talk about being led by Indigenous youth? Why should people care about this? And it is an assumption in your podcast episodes. And man, I just hope people realize that this is an important thing to do. But I'm wondering if you had like a nice, neat and tidy rationale, like give me your elevator pitch. Why is being Indigenous youth led so critical?
Yeah, I think about like what happens when you're not. And so if you're not led by Indigenous young people, you run the very serious risk of putting a lot of energy and resources and effort into programming and initiatives and activities that ultimately fail because they're missing the mark. They're not actually what young people want, or they're not delivered in the way that young people need them to be delivered, or they're maybe meeting the need and direction and vision of that organization's leadership. And maybe the leadership is sitting there thinking like, these are the economic trends of our future. This is what needs to happen. This is what the market demands. And so this is where we need to go. But if it's not actually informed by young people, it can ultimately be a very frustrating experience. And so then to frame that, I guess, more positively, youth engagement, especially of Indigenous young people, is so important because it's what can make programming the most effective, the most efficient, and ultimately the most relevant.
So true, both of those framings. Mm-hmm. So when you think about the hope for the work that you're doing, first of all, are you going to do another podcast series? Is there one in your future?
I have some like hopes and plans for a second season. I won't like commit right here to like making it happen, but I really do hope to, because I think it'd be really fun to explore. Oh yeah, I guess I'll say this. So if I don't end up doing it, maybe one of your listeners will go make a podcast about this, because I think it needs to be explored more. Like in this first season, I was looking at like, how do we do youth engagement effectively? And like, what are young people saying about effective youth engagement? I think a second season could look at what are young people saying about what makes a meaningful livelihood, especially like at the foundation. Like one of our core mandates is like, yeah, creating systems change so that Indigenous young people can fulfill like meaningful livelihoods, like meaningful employment or meaningful entrepreneurship, that they're making a meaningful livelihood for themselves in however they define that. But I'm curious about exploring more, like how is that defined by Indigenous young people, and how might a meaningful livelihood for an Indigenous young person be unique to how a non-Indigenous young person in Canada might define it? And then sort of like in tandem with that, what do Indigenous young people need from employers in order to be successful in the workplace? And how might that differ from a non-Indigenous employee? Mm-hmm. And so I think that would be something really fascinating to explore, especially with like a target audience of Canadian employers. Mm. Yeah, like maybe of all sizes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you might hear employers say things like, yeah, we want to hire natives, but like, where are they? Or like, we can't get any to apply. Or like, we tried that once. We actually hired a whole bunch of them one summer and none of them stayed. So I think it's worth exploring more, like, what are Indigenous young people saying about their experiences in the workplace?
Yeah.
Because there's often like so much wraparound support built into their experiences of, in post-secondary, their transitions into post-secondary. But then when it comes to the workplace, those supports often don't exist. And so there's a lot of challenges that Indigenous young people face in the workplace and a lot of frustrations. And I'm curious about getting into that more, like, why is that? What can be done, et cetera?
Awesome. For me, it's a logical progression from the first question that you asked in the first season of Young People Know. And I have my evaluator hat thing put on here. And I'm like, oh, yeah, of course. And what are the outcomes of employers who are actually listening to this advice and doing things in a different way that supports meaningful livelihoods as defined by Indigenous youth? So I think that's a really exciting question to be asking, in particular, as so many economists and analysts within Canadian society recognize that there is this huge potential workforce, but they keep trying things that just aren't working. And I wonder why they're not working in so many different ways. So I look forward to this upcoming season 2. I'm going to hold you to it, Sam, of Young People Know. I think the stories that you were able to gather and engage with and tell through the way that you co-produce the podcast, they're just so important. And I really, really urge listeners who are listening to this podcast, who are evaluators and researchers and community organizations, to think about, like, what does Indigenous youth engagement mean in the work that you're doing? And how can you take the lessons from the series, from Young People Know, and apply that so that we're just doing things better and more accountable to Indigenous youth and Indigenous communities in how we can show up. So that's my hope. What's your hope, Sam? What would you like to leave the listeners with ultimately? What are your hopes for this work and the work with Indigenous youth?
I think one of the things I hope they leave with is that it's really important that they do it. It's really possible to do it well. And I guess ultimately I hope that these episodes serve as sort of like a baseline. I hope these episodes sort of serve as like a baseline understanding of how things could go well, because I think so many factors will vary depending on the type of organization, the size of it, your regional context, whether you're national or local. Like, there's so many things like practically on the ground that have to be sorted out. But I hope that these stories serve as like a high level guide to some like wise practices around Indigenous youth engagement.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. We're to the end of our time together, and I'm wondering if there's any final invitation you'd like to leave the listeners with as we close off.
Yeah, I think I just go back to the title of the podcast, Young People Know. And that's really like the common thread throughout the series is that we might not necessarily know what's going to be most effective and useful for Indigenous young people, but they do know. Young people do know what will best serve them and how it will best serve them and how they want to be engaged. And so I think, yeah, I want to encourage organizations, wherever they are, whether they're not engaging Indigenous young people at all, or maybe they're doing it a little bit, or maybe they're doing it quite a bit and better than anyone else, that, yeah, that this work is so important and that, yeah, young people know what they need. And so it's just our job to find ways of effectively hearing it and then implementing what they share.
Awesome. So very true. Well, thank you so much for sharing this space with me today. I'm so grateful, and just know that this is going to be really a helpful episode for listeners. And of course, I'll include all the links to all the things in the show notes so that people can find you super easily. And Egose.
Miigwech, thank you so much.
I'm so glad you spent time with us today. I have a few notes to wrap up this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please subscribe on your favorite streaming service, including Podbean, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts, so that you don't miss an episode. Also, this podcast is self-supported, and I'm hoping to make the work more sustainable. So, if you're finding the content interesting and valuable, please consider supporting Indigenous Insights through Buy Me a Coffee. You can find the link in the show notes. Finally, I would like to extend an invitation. If you are someone who has an interest in Indigenous evaluation and would like to have a conversation on this podcast, I would love to hear from you. Please send me a note and we can connect about your work, what you're learning, and the questions you're thinking about. That's it for this week. I look forward to sharing this space with you again soon. Egose.